Welcome back, guys. DGS and KMOX, few minutes past 2 p.m. We have Alderwoman, mayoral candidate, friend of the show, Kara Spencer, with us. Always good to have you. Glad to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
That's awesome. Good to have you back. She's like, whatever.
Yeah,
let's just get this thing over with.
Yeah, pretty cool, though. We call that pulling a wheeler.
Yeah, no kidding.
Every once in a while, the phone goes, and I'm like, and you said, you heard that? I'm like, yeah, I totally heard that.
She put me right in my place.
Now, this is really, really, really important to me to be here with you today.
Yes, thank you. Clearly. I've never felt less sufficient.
We just got out of a very long board meeting.
So I imagine most of them are.
Just fried.
Meetings just don't. I go to like one meeting a year. It's one of the best things about this job. You probably go to one meeting an hour.
Oh, yeah. At least.
How many of them are fruitful? How many do you walk out and go, well, that was worth it?
You know, I mean, I was in a meeting right out front before I came in talking about lighting up Twain, the Richard Serra sculpture downtown.
Yes.
And I think, you know, I mean, there's always interesting things going on. So I think a lot of meetings are, at least in my experience, are pretty fruitful.
How different has public service been than what you thought it would be when you first got into it?
Oh my gosh, night and day, night and day. I mean, you know, I mean, there's a million reasons why I got into public service, but, you know, one of the sort of straws that broke the camel's back was just that you couldn't get a liquor license on Cherokee Street back then. And I thought, I'll go in there and just clean that up and then I'll get out of Dodge, you know? And, you know, didn't have an interest necessarily in being in it for the long haul.
Mm-hmm.
Was just interested in kind of cleaning some things up in my neighborhood. And I fell in love with it. I mean, it's clearly dysfunctional. It's, you know, sometimes, I mean, most of the time I feel like I'm banging my head against a wall. But I make real differences in people's lives, you know, business owners that just can't cut through the red tape, you know, with a couple phone calls, I can usually kind of clear the way. And I feel like I, every single day, get to make the world a little bit better for at least one person.
Nice. That's very nice.
It is.
How much, like, you can't fight City Hall sort of sentiment, how much of that feels intentional? Not just the city of St. Louis, but just like this thing is just set up to keep people out of here.
You know, trust in government is, I think, at an all-time low. That's nationally and probably internationally, worldwide. You know, I mean, I think, across the board, people just feel like government structures are not set up to help. And, you know, I believe in government specifically and especially at the municipal level to be a service delivery operation. You know, you pay taxes in and you need to get something out of it. Otherwise, you're going to go live somewhere else. And so, you know, from that perspective, I feel like we have an enormous amount of opportunities to change things for the better here.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm excited to do it.
So let's talk about the board that you recently resigned from and that kerfuffle. I understand the basics of it. I understand that there are some shenanigans going on and you did not want to be a part of their shenanigans. I think it was a wise decision. The people who I respect thought it was a wise decision. Kind of line that out for us again for the audience.
Sure. So I'm on the board of aldermen. Last year I was appointed by the president of the board to chair the Budget and Public Employees Committee on the board of aldermen. And in that role, I was also given position, an ex officio position at the SLDC board on the board of directors. SLDC is the St. Louis Development Corporation, which oversees development and economic growth, you know, for the city. And in my role there, that organization was a subgrantee of the ARPA funds, $37 million to award to North City businesses through a grant program. And I'm sure everyone listening has heard about the shenanigans, you know, and certainly the concerns around those funds getting out the door. And so when I started to really dig in and ask questions following some of those awards going out in July, became quickly apparent to me that I wasn't getting the answers that I felt like I needed to have to be able to vote on a regular basis on whether, you know, moving these programs forward. And, the reality is SLDC is a nonprofit organization set up to be separate from city government. And as such, it has an executive director, has a staff that is overseen by a board of directors, of which I was a member. Well, when the executive staff member is the same as the chair of the board appointed by the mayor. That person was chosen to be to serve two roles. You can't really oversee a board that the head of the oversight is the same as the as the staff.
Mm-hmm.
And so when that person controls the flow of information, controls the agenda, you know, it became very quickly apparent to me that I could not be effective on the as a member of the board of directors, nor do I think anybody could. I don't think the setup is appropriate. And I don't think it's a good orientation. It's certainly not a good oversight. And I feel very, very strongly that that choice by the mayor to appoint this executive staff person to be the head of the oversight board, which is supposed to be overseeing the staff, it can't be effective.
Yeah.
And so I really had to I had to step away, recognizing that I didn't have the tools to vote. And I wanted to make a strong stand that this needs to change. It needs to change.
Has it had the effect that you'd hoped for?
You know, it's gotten some publicity on it. I've had some very, very constructive conversations with my colleagues and other folks as we consider who can replace me or how that should move forward. And I feel very, very strongly that we need some safeguards in place.
Yeah.
Not just for right now, but moving forward, that the, you know, oversight board should not be one and the same as the organization that we're overseeing. It's just you know, that dual
Fox
role.
Watching the chickens.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So to the shenanigans, we don't have to get into the details, but I mean, I've been downtown since I graduated from law school in 90, one way or another, working or living or both. And I love my city and I root for my city and I support it, but I'm very realistic about it. It's like a sibling, right? They're like, oh yeah, let me tell you about that. And it just seemed like this type of shenanigan is the kind you would expect when you're not expecting much, right? Mm. And I was so disappointed to hear about all this. Like, this is the kind of thing I would expect, and I like to be pleasantly surprised, and you're unpleasantly surprising me that you're pulling these kind of things again. Does that make any sense?
Sure. But I can say that, you know, I mean, when the Board of Aldermen approved these funds, I mean, we all had high expectations. Look, getting through COVID was tough for everybody, and it was especially tough for small businesses in North St. Louis, where the population is decreasing, where, you know, it's just tough to make things work up there when you see such devastation and population loss. And, you know, I certainly didn't expect it to go this badly, you know, and to be this far along. I mean, we have had these businesses applied in 2022. We're 2.5 years later. I mean, not only are we giving out awards to businesses that clearly shouldn't be getting them, but, you know, these businesses, most of them aren't getting anything. And certainly we're way past the pandemic, the height of it. And these funds have really done nothing to really help the business. And more importantly, and perhaps more damaging, is the breakdown of trust. I mean, if you think about, if you're a business owner or homeowner or even a resident thinking about moving or leave, you know, or moving in, trust is key.
Yes.
It's key. And I think that is going to be a much harder thing to rebuild than even the, you know,
Couldn't agree more. The
businesses. It's just the work in front of us.
It takes years to build and minutes to destroy.
It's true.
You know, like all trust. Trust and safety. And speaking of safety, I saw a news story today about the governor-elect having kind of a pee and match with Tashara. And over the crime statistics and the state takeover, and she's vehemently against it. He thinks it's a good idea. Where do you come down on that?
You know, I mean, I want to see a local control remain. I think it's really important too. But look, I mean, I understand why many officers want to see state control. I mean, we have difficult time getting them the basic things they need. You know, procurement. It's this sort of bureaucracy involved in the city that has made, you know, their lives less than optimal, especially these new recruits. You know, you're not getting the number of shirts with, camera holes and those things. You know, if you're a new recruit coming right out of college and, you know, you're living in an apartment, you don't have a washer dryer. I mean, these are things that have a really, really impactful negative impact on your quality of life. And if the city can't do those basic things in an optimal way, I mean, I can understand why the reversion is it's so preferable.
A part of that story was Mayor Jones saying, well, look at the crime statistics. They're all down, significantly. And as a downtowner, I don't feel that. And I'm wondering whether that's a Dave problem or a communications problem, perhaps, on the part of the city.
Well, look, Dave, I don't know about your problems. Okay.
you have a pretty good idea.
We do.
Yeah, you have some
like
idea.
You got a lot of problems.
Yeah. It didn't take you long.
We're not here to talk about your problems, but I think that, you know, I mean, I hear that from everybody. I mean, you know, I mean, yes, your statistics say one thing, but I don't feel safer. You're not alone in that. And certainly I was sitting there doing homework with my kid last night, and there was gunfire out front, and my kid didn't even flinch. You know, I'm thinking, oh my gosh, you know, but the reality is to keep telling people over and over and over again that we're safer, you're safer, you're safer, doesn't make anybody feel safer. It just makes people mad. And that's the reality that we're living in, and I do think that we need to meet people where they are. If you don't feel safe, you don't feel safe. I don't care what the numbers say. And certainly we've seen some issues of transparency across departments, and that translates into whether or not you trust those numbers.
I was going to say, is there a standard way that those numbers are compiled? And is there a standard that would say we're using this standard the same way we did 10 years ago, the same way we did 20 years ago, whatever, so that you can actually put it into a frame of reference rather than, well, we count differently now than we did then, or we count the same as the FBI counts. That's like, is there a standard in place for that?
Yeah, I mean, so the FBI really changed those standards a couple of years ago. The city lagged behind national average on getting those up to those new standards. And certainly, I mean, we've seen, you know, there's been some questions associated with, you know, how those standards are being applied, you know, whether or not, you know, a car break-in situation where we've got 12 cars broken in is counted as one event or 12. And we've got, you know, I mean, I've seen some credible questions to it. But the reality is, regardless of all that, I mean, as you said, I mean, Dave, I mean, if you don't feel safe, you don't feel safe. And the reality is that I'm hearing from people is they just don't feel safer. And I think it all comes down to trust. It just does.
Yeah.
You know, and when you don't trust your SLDC, you know, we've got, I mean, it's basic stuff. I mean, we can't trust who's running the jail right now. You know, the person that was in charge is on leave. We have no idea why. You know, we have just recently the director of NIS, the neighbor stabilization team, was relieved of her duties, apparently, with nothing more than an email to all of us. We have no idea why. You know, personnel director is still not here. I mean, there's just an ongoing series of what's going on here, who's in charge. And I think that just compiles into lack of trust. It is applied across the board.
So given this sort of spider web of distrust and mistrust that we have established over years and even decades, how does a Mayor Spencer attack that?
I think it just comes down to being present, being honest, you know, being consistent, you know, in answering to tough questions. I mean, I think real consistency on how you display the data, how you share it, having a real commitment to doing that. And look, there's going to be times when the data is not in our favor. You know, vacancy is going to have blips. You're going to go up. You're going to go down. Just being willing to stomach that and move forward and say, look, the most important thing is that you believe where we're coming from. You know, I had a guy in North St. Louis a couple weeks ago say, look, I want to know where you are. We're on reparations. And if you're not on for reparations, I'm not with you. And I had to say, man, I don't know how the city would pay for that. First of all, let me say, I don't have any doubt that the city, the state, the federal governments, the actions that these, you know, systems have taken have had a real negative impact on your life, on where you are right now and your opportunities. But the reality is a taxing structure like St. Louis, where we're losing population, we don't have the tax. But if we took all the taxes, you know, for 3 years in a row and put them all together, it still wouldn't be enough. And I got to say, that guy looked at me like this was not the answer I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
It was not the answer I expected. But after what felt like 5 minutes of boring into my, you know, he said, well, at least you didn't lie to me.
Good for you.
And I think that's that space where it's not always comfortable and it doesn't always feel good. But, you know, you can march your foot one foot in front of the other together and say, look, but I am going to fix your potholes. Okay.
Yeah.
And I am going to make trash pickup better. And here are the ways in which I'm going to do that.
Excellent start. You know? Good for you. I like everything about that. Thank you, Kara. Always good to see you. Appreciate
it. Yep. Next time I'll put my phone behind me.
We're going to take it from you. Used to be so good.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess you can say that about anything.
I know. I saw them in 2017. Yeah. They played at Lou Fest, and it was still, I mean, it was fun to see them play.
Yeah. Were they good?
They were pretty low energy, to be honest, but it was like, that's Weezer.
Yeah.
They did Pinkerton. I like that album.
I felt that way about seeing Pat Benatar out at Riverport. She was with Night Ranger and REO. And Night Ranger and REO killed it. They sounded great. They're running around like crazy. And Pat, maybe she had a fight with Neil or something, but she was just sort of standing there and singing and, you know, left me cold. Way to go, Pat. Razor's Edge?
That's it, Pat.
Thanks, Pat.
That was your last
Thanks
chance.
Thanks for nothing.
Yeah, Razor's Edge. I wanted to talk about this article that I read on a website called ZME Science by an Alexandra Guerrera.
Alexander.
It's how internet slang has become part of everyday language. I just thought this was kind of interesting. Do you guys ever find yourself saying, and let's say it's ironic, saying like, oh, BRB or like LOL, ever?
Yes. OMG.
Ever saying
that?
Yes.
I know Andrew does from time to time. I definitely do. I will say BRB ironically, and then it kind of slips out unironically too. Mm-hmm. But this was just a very interesting article kind of detailing the progression of internet slang making its way into real life. So internet slang first became mainstream in the 90s along with the internet. We had email, instant messaging, and early social networks caused people to use abbreviations like LOL or TTY, I'll talk to you later, out of necessity, basically, because you wanted to keep the conversation going at a certain pace. So you're going to type an abbreviation to get your point across quicker. Then by the mid-2000s, the real big social media platforms came around like Facebook and Twitter, and that brought internet slang into the mainstream, especially Twitter, because you only had at the time 140 characters to get your point across. So you were abbreviating many, many things. So that bore slang terms like TBT, Throwback Thursday, which we will be doing today on the Dave Glover Show.
Didn't know that
and
one.
And SMH, shaking my head, is a big one. Now you will see this popping up in TV shows, movies, sometimes even news programs incorporating internet slang. Oftentimes it's in a ironic tongue-in-cheek way, but it's still happening. But I found this very interesting. A recent study found that over 80% of text messages now contain some form of internet slang or abbreviation.
I had to learn it because of my daughter.
Really?
Yeah. She's a whole lot of like RN, and I'm like, I don't know what that means.
Is she talking about a nurse?
Yeah. I've Googled things like that many, many times.
Yeah, you've asked us before. Yes. You're like, what does this one mean?
Yeah.
What does FOMO mean? But that's a great example. Acronyms like FOMO or YOLO, these are fear of missing out or you only live once, are now commonly used in advertising campaigns, marketing campaigns. And, you know, some critics worry that the rise of internet slang is going to bring about the decline of language in general. They're saying we're becoming more lazy. But
evolution.
I kind of look at it as, if I can throw an LOL on the end of a text message to soften it and to show you, hey, I'm not mad.
Well, think about the way we spoke in the 1700s. You know, well, heretofore.
Right. And
we used to speak the Queen's English.
Yeah, and they would look at us and think we're barbarians.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Welcome back, guys. DGS on KMOX 234. So the other night we had sort of an industry happy hour, and I was talking to a gentleman named Greg, who is a live entertainment producer for Steve Lippman Presents, and he's been in the business for decades now, and we just had a really interesting conversation, and I wanted to invite him to be here on the show. Anyone who has been to see shows in St. Louis or the surrounding areas, good chance that Greg had his finger in that pie. Good to see you again. Thanks for coming in. Appreciate
it. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah. Get right up on that mic there, even though you have a good voice. So just introduce yourself. Do a better job than I just did and tell people what it is you've done all these years.
Well, I've been in this market for about 45 years. I started out in the record business in St. Louis, moving from Minneapolis, and spent about 3 or 4 years pitching records to radio stations all around the Midwest.
What was that like back in the day?
It was great. It was great. It was a, you know, I was 23 years old and thought I had the world by the tail.
Yeah,
you
probably did.
You know, renting cars and buying dinners for program directors and, you know, living the good life.
So, for example, you'd go to Casey and you're repping REO.
Right.
How would that go? How would that conversation go?
An REO Speedwagon album was you barely had to deliver it, you know. But if you were working a new record, you know, you'd, you know, maybe trying to take the PD out for lunch or dinner and make sure he heard it and played it. And, you know, you give him stats and information from around the country. This radio station was playing it. That radio station was playing it. You know, with Casey, it was kind of do or die. They either played it or didn't play it. There was no middle ground. And as a matter of fact, I kind of hold a record there of the most classic. One of the people that has the most classic tracks. Kind of one-hit wonders that made it on Casey.
So we have you to thank for that.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Some of my favorite music.
Everything from Mama Let Him Play by Jerry Doucette. Thank you. And Gypsy.
Yeah.
Dead and Gone. And
I remember Mark Close, who was on the show for 10 years, used to tell stories about having big companies come in to do testing.
Right.
And they would come back and say, what the hell is wrong with St. Louis? Like, you guys have the strangest musical taste we've ever seen.
It was amazing. I mean, you hear some great stories. A dear friend of mine, Ron Stevens, who you met briefly the other night, buying a record at a KXOK record sale.
Love
you know, they have big tents and all the promo records, and they'd sell these records for 10 cents a piece. And one of them that he bought was J.D. Blackfoot, which has been a huge classic at KSHE for years and years and years. So it's funny ways that records get on. I've got a cute story with I was in Minneapolis. I was a record buyer for a company called J.L. Marsh Heilitzer Brothers, Pickwick. And it was the largest distributor and retailer of records in the world. And I was 22 years old and had just bought a new Brownsville Station 45. The record guys from New York came in and pitched me hard on it. And it was Lady Put the Light Out, which was a hit record.
Yeah.
And I bought a huge amount of the 45, a huge amount of the album. We were pushing it out the doors. And I get a phone call and they go, Greg, we're pulling the single. I go, what do you mean you're pulling the single? The record just hit the warehouse floor. And they go, well, there's this radio station in St. Louis is playing another track on the album, and they're drilling it. And I go, what track? And they go, Martian Boogie. And I go, Martian Boogie? What are you putting me on? You know, that's going to be the new single? And I go, well, who's in charge there? Who's putting it? Well, Ted Hobbick. He's the one that's playing it. And I go, well, screw Ted Hobbick.
what kind of power does he have?
Doesn't he understand that that's not part of the game plan? So, Casey was very powerful.
And back then, I mean, jocks are still important, don't get me wrong, but back then, jocks were kind of everything. Because you know, you could have Randy Raley playing one thing, and Radio Rich wouldn't play it, and Close would play this and that.
Yeah. No, and you know, you work the jocks. You know, you back in the day, I mean, I made sure that we had mail slots for each of them to send them newsletters or sample records or... You worked the disc jockeys at Casey. I mean, you know, it was... You know,
and that's where the whole, like, plugola, payola stuff comes from, because that was happening back, like, especially in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, that was more centered towards Top 40 radio, I think, you know, was, you know, the... you know, it happened in a lot of different formats. I mean, you know, AOR radio was not you know, guilt-free in that
one
either.
And I know all the artists were different personalities, and a lot of them were strange, but what was it like working with the personalities back then?
The disc jockeys?
No, the artists themselves.
Oh, the artists themselves. You know, when you were in the record business, you had a tighter relationship with the artists, you know, because back when I was in the record business, it was the record business that drove their career. It was where their revenue was, their money was, and, you know, you'd get them airplay, and they were, you know, sold records. Now it's flipped.
Yeah.
You know, the record business is non-existent. Radio is all diffused. So it's the touring that's the business. But, you know, I used to have some great relationships with guys. They'd put me on the road with certain bands just to make sure that kind of hold hands. And I had a lot of I worked for some of the smaller labels, Chrysalis Records and Arista Records. So a lot of my bands were baby bands, just now getting started.
Like who? Name drop for us.
The Babies.
Love them.
Yeah, which was huge records in St. Louis, thanks to the radio in St. Louis, period. Not only Keishi, but, you know, other radio stations, too, came to the front on that one, too. You know, Eric Carmen, who used to be with the Strawberries, mm-hmm. you know, All By Myself was a huge record.
One of Rachel's favorites.
Yeah, you know, it was, you know, it was fun. It was fun to break a record and know that you really had a contribution yeah. to that. You know, going to Salina, Kansas on Thursday to talk to the program director there to play a record and take a chance. Because if you could get Salina to play it, then you could get Topeka to play it. And then on and on and on to Kansas City and then to St. Louis.
Has the shift from selling records to playing live as your moneymaker, has it been neutral for the artist, or has this been a good thing or a bad thing for the artists?
Well, you know, I think it's the 80-20 rule out there. 20% of the artists are making money. The other 80% are having a tough time. You know, it's so costs so much money to tour. You know, I mean, I just got a tour rider the other day for a show that we're looking to put on at the Sheldon, just a little show at the Sheldon. And, you know, they got 15 touring members, you know, so you got buses and salaries and, you know, it's just tough to make money. And, you know, the business has been great post COVID. I mean, it has been, you know, the second coming in terms of, you know, ticket selling. You know, St. Louis is so vibrant now. You know, you've got three arenas. You've got, you know, the Factory. You know, you've got the Pageants. You've got all these great venues now. And all of them are booked. All of them are full.
That's great.
You know, and it's really rewarding that, you know, that this market, you know, I never thought that, as I fondly refer to it as Hooterville, you know, could sustain that kind of talent load. But it's, you know, all, you know, water rises, makes all boats float.
You and Ron were talking candidly about shows that you'd lost money on, and I found that fascinating. Yeah. And I was asking you guys, like, how do you lose money? What do you do? And you said, you basically overpay the artist.
Yeah, there are no bad bands, just bad deals. You know, it's, you just guess wrong. I mean, and unfortunately, this business is still a lot of it unsophisticated. You just kind of are guessing. A lot of it is on gut. You make a few phone calls, talk to some of your peers around the country, see how they did in that market or this market. But, you know, when you're wrong, it can be, you know, it can be a big hit.
Yeah.
You know,
if you're just tuning in, we're talking to Greg Haglund, live entertainment producer for Steve Lippman Presents. We're talking about the old days when he was breaking artists on Keishi and right up to today, and how the artists are making their money from touring, not so much from records. Would you say that it's easier, more difficult, or about the same for an artist to break with the internet and everything these days?
Well, in some respects, it's easier because they have so many different. If they're good, if the bands are good, and it usually is the bands themselves, not necessarily the people around them, you know how to suss out getting streaming video and streaming music on Spotify, and they've got a lot of tools themselves where they're not dependent on the record company.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's so many new bands out, too, you know, that you can just cut the pie up so many ways.
Yeah.
And, you know, unfortunately, too, you know, the younger generation, I kind of call it Kleenex rock. You kind of blow your nose in it once and throw it away, and you're done with that band. Whereas before, you know, you waited for the new album to come out. You know, it was on a Tuesday, and you lined up at Streetside Records in New City and, you know, got your record. And I don't see as much longevity on new bands as there used to be.
Yeah.
You know, again, 80-20 rule different. Taylor Swift, huge, always will be huge, has been huge. I heard you guys played a little Pearl Jam on the drive down here. You know, it's you know, those kinds of bands will be legacy bands.
Yeah.
But newer bands are, it's
so tougher.
Keep a following.
You guys can ask questions if you want. I'm totally dominating this conversation because it's
I'm
so interesting.
I'm just sitting there listening like, man, this is cool.
So Kev's like a metal guy.
Yeah.
He's like a Slipknot, Megadeth, Metallica kind of guy. Did you ever dip your toe into that stuff?
Oh, sure. We did Metallica at Riverport several times. And in fact, I've got a neat show coming up at the Factory. In fact, I scribbled down some notes.
Yeah, are you talking about March? Or is it more recent or coming up sooner?
March 11th. The Rock Orchestra?
Yeah.
Are you hip to that?
Yeah. I don't know them much. I know right before that, I guess Killswitch Engage is coming in, which I'm also...
Right.
Yeah. That's my wheelhouse.
We do all the shows at the Factory. We do, you know, a fair amount over the course of a year, but This one's called the Rock Orchestra by Candlelight. And they're playing music from Metallica and AC/DC and the Stones and Rage Against the Machine. And it's really
awesome.
It's really going to be a very cool show. And
To what extent did you have to check your personal taste at the door when you were working with artists? And sometimes you're like, they're really not my cup of tea. But
A little bit. But, you know, the good news about being in this business all these years was that I was exposed to so much different music and comedy and spoken word and gospel. And, you know, that I got to learn to appreciate, you know, the stuff that I would have turned my nose up to maybe before without listening to it. And that, you know, that happened from the record business. You know, you really had to understand the bands before you could buy the records, and once again, calling people and getting their opinion on it. But I haven't really, you know, held my nose and promoted a show, you know, I can't even think of it.
Did you get intimidated much?
By artists?
Yeah.
There were some, you know, Barry Manilow stands out. He was kind of a tyrant and, you know, he was, you know, I remember soundcheck. Nobody could be in the arena during soundcheck. Ushers, janitors, promoters, nobody, you know, which I guess was his thing. But, you know, it made it difficult to stop in the middle of the day and leave and then come back. And
did you feel more like you were herding cats or more like you were their dads, like to a lot of these bands?
I think, you know, people like Steve Shankman and Irv Zuckerman, who had these really long-term relationships with these bands when I was at Contemporary, you know, older brother, you know, come to him for sound advice. You know, the relationship that Irv had with bands was, and Steve for that matter, but Irv more so because he was the booker, you know, they really relied on his opinion. And the both of them were managers. They managed Teddy East and Starcastle. So they knew how to, you know, communicate with bands, make best interests for them. It was, you know, but, you know, kind of older brother, I think, was who had been more, you know, there's always herding cats, but, you know, we forget about those days.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, this is a lot of fun. Yeah. I really appreciate you coming in.
Oh, it's been great.
Yeah,
it's
this is cool. Come back and bring Ron or Teddy with you. That would be.
I certainly will.
It'd be a lot of fun.
I certainly will. Absolutely.
Thank you, Greg. Appreciate
you.
It, my friend.
Thank you.
253 DGS on KMOX. Man, that was a fun segment.
Very fun.
Just love, like, we're just talking about it on the break. You always know it's a good segment when we keep talking about it on the break with Greg Haglund there. And did you enjoy that, Andrew?
It was awesome.
Yeah.
I love hearing about that stuff. I love the history of radio, and I love hearing about, like, the inner workings of how it used to be. Because, you know, you grow up thinking about the radio and you learn about the radio from like watching movies, and then once you get here you find that it's very different. I at least it was very different to my eyes, and then I found out like, oh no, it used to be like that.
Yeah
it's just completely different now.
It's like
it changed about 2 years before you
it's like a movie
involved.
That you saw and then you learn no, it really was like that.
Yeah, exactly. And it's always so cool to hear about that stuff and how things
we're just saying work. How for us we have stars in our eyes about shows. And for someone like Greg or Ron, it's, okay, we have 15 guys. We got to feed 15 guys. What's the cheapest way to feed 15 guys? Mm-hmm. There's so much of just like the down and dirty to make this show happen. The piano's out of tune. Got to get a piano tuner. This guy's $300. This guy's $200. Get the $200 guy. Like, that's just so interesting. And we have a bit of that where people will come into the studio and you can tell it's like, oh, this is so cool. And it's radio and it's KMOX and the voices and you look different than I thought you did. And this is just like our kitchen. Mm-hmm. Like we're just so used to this that it's not that I don't like what I do. I love what I do. But the shine's off the apple as far as being impressed.
And as a, you know, as a producer, like I'm kind of nerdy learning about like the logistics of stuff. I love to learn the logistics.
Yes.
Because that's, you know, there's some of that in this job on a smaller scale, you know, more how do I feed two people versus how do I feed 15 people or whatever.
Yeah.
But hearing about, like, you know, we had to clear out the whole stadium because, you know, Rod Stewart wouldn't have anybody.
Yeah, Barry Manilow.
Or Barry Manilow, rather, wouldn't hear have anybody, you know, hearing him sound check or whatever. I love hearing
He's the Wheeler of music.